Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of important stories in the news, beginning with the collision course the US and Iran are on that could result in another war in the Gulf, which at a minimum would drive oil prices way up in an election year. A veteran CIA officer, Robert Baer, joins us to discuss the lethal mixture of Iranian paranoia, Israeli threats, and American election year politics that, combined with provocative naval exercises, could result in an incident that would spark a wider conflagration. Then we'll continue looking into this incendiary mix with Vali Nasser, an Iranian-born professor of international politics at Tufts University, who was recently the senior advisor to President Obama's special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. We will discuss Iranian President Ahmadinejad's trip to Venezuela, Cuba, Ecuador, and Nicaragua to gain support as sanctions ratchet up, and Iran announces a new drill to close the Straits of Hormuz, codenamed the Great Prophet, that will coincide with joint U.S.-Israeli exercises in the Gulf, codenamed Austere Challenge 12. Then finally, as Arab League foreign ministers meet in Cairo, we will assess new efforts to give some backbone to the Arab League monitors in Syria as the Assad clan continues its murderous repression of the Syrian people. Dr. Muraf Juwajati, a former Syrian diplomat in touch with the Syrian opposition, who now teaches at the National Defense University, joins us. We will discuss whether UN human rights experts will be allowed to bolster the toothless mission that so far has been unable to stop the killing. I'm now joined by Robert Baer, a veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle East countries, including Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria. He is the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, dealing with the Iranian superpower, the new Iranian superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife, Dana, is The Company We Keep, a husband and wife's true life spy story. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Baer.
Good morning.
So there's so much activity going on in the Gulf, not just in terms of the threats that are made by almost all of the Republican candidates. They seem to be tripping over each other in these debates to be the first to bomb Iran. But there's some movements on the ground that are quite troubling. There's a very, very big exercise underway in Israel involving about 9,000 U.S. soldiers that are arriving now along with an aircraft carrier. That's also it's an anti-missile defense exercise as well as combined naval exercises in the Gulf. The Iranians are just announcing that after having just completed an exercise to shut down the Straits of Hormuz, they're going to start another one next month. And the Russians have just deployed a Russian naval flotilla led by an aircraft carrier just docked in the Syrian port of Tartus. I thought the Cold War was over.
Well, there's a couple points I'd like to make, and one is that I think what we're looking at here today is a policy based on Israel's threat to hit Iran's nuclear facilities. And the administration has come back to Israel and said, no, it's not doable, it's too dangerous, we'll pay the price, etc. And in return, the administration has said, let's make one final effort at sanctions, true sanctions, on Iranian oil, on its central bank, get the Europeans to stop buying it, and a couple other countries, and give us a chance to make sanctions work. And in the meantime, there's been a lot of saber rattling in exercises in Israel, moving another aircraft carrier into the Gulf and the rest of it. And I think the administration is hoping this is an end game into pressuring Iran to giving up its nuclear program. I mean, at the same time, the Iranians don't have a nuclear weapon, and they're not close to getting one. Panetta was on Sunday talk shows saying, they're acquiring the knowledge, but they're a long way from actually testing and getting a bomb, which, of course, isn't the way the neocons portray it or the Republican candidates. This is an election year, fine. But I'll tell you what disturbs me is Iran. How much more pressure can they take before they react? I've been talking to some friends in Washington who said this attempt on the Saudi ambassador, these are people I trust. I don't think they're spinning it for me. They think it was real, that there's some irrational side of the Iranian government that won't take well the pressure. If you press the Iranians hard enough, they become paranoid, and they do things that are not in their interest and certainly not in ours. So what I'm trying to say is this escalation could get out of hand very quickly, and it could snap any day at any time where some element in Iran attacks one of our boats, fires a missile across the Gulf, and from there it's impossible to tell where the conflict would go.
So at this point, Robert Baer, is this escalation of the sanctions and turning on the screws and these naval exercises, etc., is this America's way of? I mean, who's running the show here? Are the Israelis saying? And we know that there have been previously a lot of warnings from senior Israeli military officials and intelligence officials that they were concerned that Netanyahu was too adventurous and too belligerent in this regard, even for them. So are the Israelis basically saying to the Americans, look, if you guys don't do something effective, like cripple them with sanctions, we're going to go ahead and attack? Is that how this game is being played?
I think it's a smart gamble on the part of the Israelis. I mean, this is an election year in this country. They've got a voice through their supporters in Congress and through the GOP candidates. I think it's a very smart move on their time. Get what they can while they can, and you know, put a lot of pressure on. And because by next year, after the elections, they won't have that sort of leverage.
Well, but could it be worse than that, in a sense that we know that Netanyahu's loyalties are entirely with the Republicans? They fated him recently in the Congress in a way that was almost unprecedented in terms of their almost adoration of him. Given what's happening now with these Republican candidates who are voicing all of this belligerence or competing to be the most belligerent against Iran, many of whom are being advised by the neocons, I sense, when you mentioned paranoia in Iran, Robert Baer, I sense a kind of symbiosis between the IRGC people who are running the show in Iran, who are incredibly paranoid, and they've effectively squashed all opposition. I don't think this notion of the embers burning under the ashes is. I think that's wishful thinking on the part of liberals. I don't think
go ahead. More than that, I mean, if you're in the IRGC and you failed to do anything for Iran economically, wouldn't you welcome some sort of an attack now? Simply to demonstrate to the Iranians, look, we're under siege. We're being attacked. We haven't done anything. We haven't built a nuclear bomb. We're being strangled. This is neocolonialism. It's a very simple message to sell to the Iranians and for them to regain some influence and power, and more than they already have. So what it scares me is this is sort of a logic of war where one country wants to force an issue and the other one, you know, wants to play the game too. And this doesn't even get to the whole question of what's happening in the Middle East, Iraq, which is facing the abyss in terms of a civil war. You've got the Saudis are sending money into the Sunnis. The Iranians are supporting radical groups, which are joining Maliki's government now and have a huge influence on it. And then the Iranians are also paranoid about Syria because they don't want to lose Syria. That's sort of their outlet to the Arab world, to Hamas, to Hezbollah. And you've got Hezbollah that's paranoid as well. So there's all these movable pieces at any point could change the picture overnight.
Well, when you say, Robert Baer, that the IRGC are basically telling the Iranian people that we're under siege from a colonial power, That's apparently pretty much what President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is saying, at least he's quoted as saying, as he left on Sunday for this trip to Latin America, that where he will go to Venezuela, Cuba, Ecuador, and Nicaragua, saying that he's going there to resist the oppression of the United States and shore up an anti-colonial view.
Well, that's, Ian, that scares me. I mean, that's just pathetic on his part. Or if he is delusional enough to matter, you know, to think that Venezuela could do anything for Iran, he's not thinking very clearly. But this comes back to Iranian paranoia when they feel encircled, as they did in the 80s in the Iran-Iraq War. They exported violence. And this is something I had hoped they'd gotten over. But if you continue to encircle them, they will turn to violence. And they have a lot of capabilities in the Gulf that we just can't immediately. It would take weeks to get rid of their missiles on a bombardment. In the meantime, you know, could they take out a lot of Gulf oil productions? I think so. You know, a missile expert might disagree with me, but I think they could.
Well, apparently this exercise that's going on now between the U.S. and Israel, called Austere Challenge 12, where the U.S. is deploying apparently a lot of anti-missile equipment and training to coordinate with the Israelis, who've also invested heavily in anti-missile deployment. The Israeli military historian Martin von Kriwall is quoted as saying that this is actually all directed at Iran, in the sense that Israel is preparing for an inevitable Iranian counterattack should Israel attack the Iranian nuclear sites. So again, you know, this is more than rumors of war. This is talk of war.
No, I mean, the last time we talked, we were sort of ridiculed about rumors of war, but I think it's come to pass. You know, we are much closer than we talked about, was it 3 or 4 months ago? It's worrying a lot of people. You see the Gulf Arabs are preparing. You're seeing money moved around. And, you're seeing these proxy conflicts between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Syria is one of them, where Saudi Arabia is supporting the street, the Muslim Brotherhood, et cetera, and Iran is supporting the regime. But when does a proxy conflict, again, get out of hand? And go back to the attempt on the Saudi ambassador, Adel Jaber. If that really did happen, I mean, that is a bad sign if they're going to set off a bomb in Washington in a crowded restaurant. That's an act of war. But see, this is what the State Department is going on. It worries people at the State Department. I know that this the Iranians have become irrational. And I think if, in fact, the Europeans stop buying their oil, if they are truly, you know, this stuff is embargoed, the Iranians won't let it stand.
Well, apparently they probably will lose the European markets. They won't lose China and India. There's been a lot of pressure on India not to buy Iranian oil, but they have resisted so far. But at the very least, they'll have to discount their oil, and that will cut into their revenues that keep their people happy. And you know, as far as I can tell, in terms of internal Iranian politics, they've successfully squashed the opposition. In fact, it's two right-wing groups arguing amongst themselves, Ahmadinejad and the parliamentary speaker. But again, I sense a kind of symbiosis there between the Iranian hardliners and our neocons. They're sort of creating each other's nemesis.
I think everybody's itching for a war. And this president, he started out his administration by trying to, you know, deal with Iran, and he failed just like Clinton did. He did try. He's getting swept up in this, and his immediate concern is to keeping Netanyahu from bombing Iran. And he cannot be sure that he won't do it. And the only way to do that is put so pressure on Iran, and this comes back to the logic of war.
But is there any way that the U.S. could distance themselves from an Israeli attack? I mean, could they just sort of say, well, this is not us, and sit
Absolutely.
On the sidelines?
It wouldn't make any difference at all. The Iranians still believe that British imperialism controls the Middle East. I mean, they're dated on their mythology. So I think that whatever we said, whatever actions we took, it would still look as if we were behind it, and the Iranians are going to retaliate where they can, which would be in, you know, Doha and in Bahrain, where we've got the Fifth Fleet. Those would be two places, and of course oil, and whether they would bring in Hezbollah firing rockets in Israel or not, I don't know. But remember, the Israelis are still smarting from the 2006 war, which was fought to a standstill, and they're still worried about these rockets. So this would be a great opportunity for them to finally do something about Hezbollah, as they said they would.
Well, into this mix, though, you have what's going on in Syria, which has to be alarming Hezbollah. But what could also alarm them even further is apparently the Qataris have set up a highly mobile force to boost the anti-Assad Free Syrian Army, whose numbers now have reached about 20,000 fighters. This is a force of about 2,500 who have been trained in Libya. They were the people who actually took Tripoli. They're apparently located in the Turkish town of Antioch, on the border there, and they're getting money, as you mentioned earlier, from both the Saudis and the Qataris, and they're also in league with some of the Sunni fighting forces inside of who've been responsible for these bombings inside of Iraq. So I think if the Assad's fall, it'll be a big blow to Hezbollah and Iran, but would it also embolden the Sunnis in Iraq and further complicate the tenuous situation in Iraq?
Oh, I think absolutely. I think that once you get a real civil war going on in Levant, it'd be very easy to spread. I mean, you know, you look at sectarian makeup of Lebanon, Syria, and Iraq, and it's a tinderbox, which could go up at any time. And I don't see anybody out there offering a compromise, especially in Syria. I talked to the Muslim Brotherhood the other day, the Syrian Muslim Brotherhood. I said, why isn't the State Department doing something to help us in the street? I said, well, they're worried about slaughter afterwards, you know, sectarian slaughter. And I said, by the way, what do you do with the Alawites? That's the minority regime there. He said, well, you kill them. That's obvious. And I said, well, you see why the State Department's worried? But that's the kind of mentality that can be unleashed at any point.
Well, apparently that the Assads and the Alawites are building a kind of redoubt in the northwestern mountains above Latakia.
That's where they're from originally, yeah. They, right. You know, that's the other thing. Let's send the Alawites back to the mountain where they belong.
Right.
You know, when you have ethnic cleansing like that in a Middle Eastern country, it always leads to more violence. It's inevitable. And I don't see any compromise on either side, either the Alawites or the Sunnis. And then you got the whole question of the Christians, too, which where do they go?
Well, but the critics of both Obama and of the Republicans on our side keep talking about diplomacy. Well, you mentioned earlier, Robert Baer, that Obama tried it and it got nowhere. I assume that the reason is that the IRGC and the Supreme Leader and these paranoids that are running Iran are so invested in the great Satan as a way to keep their people together or keep their regime legitimized that they're not about to give that up.
They also believe in it. The Supreme Leader lost his hand in an explosion, and it was dissidents inside the government that blew his hand off. But until this day, he still tells people and truly believes it was the CIA that tried to assassinate him. And this drives the man, this myth of the CIA. I mean, you know, Christ, if Khamenei could read the CIA files on Iran, he would just laugh. It's a country that we understand almost nothing about. It's very distant. We have no political influence there. And so when anybody talks about unleashing the CIA covert action on Iran, it's just take it as nonsense, as complete nonsense. We're just too distant from that country. It's not doable. So, I mean, you know, when we deal with Iran, it's so much mythology and so much misinformation And that's always the problem when you don't understand a country. You know, when you invade it, you generally invade countries you understand. And that's what happened to us in Iraq.
Well, meanwhile, there's no diplomacy. The sanctions are ratcheting up. And now you have, into this volatile mix, you've got the Iranians announcing a new exercise to close the Straits of Hormuz starting next month. Operation, what is it called, Great Prophet or something? And then you've got this other U.S. Joint U.S.-Israeli exercise going on.
This is why oil is shot over $100 a barrel again. I mean, these people that trade in oil deal in fact, generally. And they are, you know, trading on futures market because they're truly worried about a conflict.
So at the very least, anything, even if it doesn't come to a full-scale war, it's going to affect the price of oil in an election year, already is. That's bad news for Obama.
It's terrible news for Obama. I mean, if oil were to go to $200-$300 a barrel, I don't think I think anybody can beat Obama. I think Michelle Bachmann could come back in the election and beat him.
Well, on that note, Robert Baer, I have to leave you, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay. Again, I've been speaking with Robert Baer, veteran CIA operations officer who served in various Middle Eastern countries, including Iraq, Lebanon, and Syria. He's the author of three New York Times bestsellers, See No Evil, which was made into the movie Syriana, Sleeping with the Devil, and The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. His latest book, co-written with his wife Dana, is The Company We Keep, a husband and wife's true life spy story. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Vali Nasser about this same subject. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Vali Nasser, Professor of International Politics at Tufts University. He was born in Iran and migrated with his family to the United States following the 1979 Islamic Revolution. His books include The Rise of Islamic Capitalism, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class, and What It Will Mean to Our World, and The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran. Between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as a senior advisor to the Special Representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vali Nasser.
Thank you.
And I just was speaking with former CIA officer Robert Baer, who's spent quite a lot of his career in Iran and in Lebanon dealing with Hezbollah. And he gives a pretty bleak picture of this potential conflagration that could happen with all these military exercises going on with Russian fleets in Syria, American fleets in Israel, and Iranian exercises coming up in the next month, again, after following recent exercises to close the Straits of Hormuz. And what I got from him was this sense that the Iranian regime is paranoid to begin with and increasingly so.
I don't believe it's an issue of paranoia. I mean, they're very rationally looking at the fact that the administration's policy towards Iran is pressure, pressure, and more pressure. And even if they came to the negotiating table tomorrow morning, there's not going to be, even in a very successful negotiation cycle, a deal before a year and a half from now. And in this time period, they're going to get weaker and weaker And even if the negotiations are successful at the end, they will have to give up their nuclear program at a point of their greatest weakness that would make them vulnerable before protests and uprisings domestically. And by that time, the United States and the West would have cut them completely out of the oil market. So it's a lose-lose situation. And therefore, they've decided that they need to act aggressively now to sort of thwart these sanctions.
So what then do you make of Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's five-day trip to Latin America, to Venezuela, Cuba, Ecuador, and Nicaragua, where he's talking about resisting oppression and of the United States and developing an anti-colonial coalition, if you will? Is that an act of desperation?
No, I think it's a very sort of a shrewd public diplomacy internationally to try to say we're not isolated, we have options, and it's also a way of shoring confidence at home by saying that, you know, he's able to go on an international trip. There are countries that are receiving him, that Iran has some allies abroad. You know, when it comes to this sort of game of brinkmanship, governments have to sort of play to the public. There is a spin, if you would, out there in order to make you look less jittery or less vulnerable or less isolated than you are. Latin America for the past decade has served for Iran as a way of trying to create a certain degree of diplomatic run room when the United States has been trying to cut Iran's diplomatic relations in Europe and in the Middle East and elsewhere. So it's basically part of the same game of tit for tat that they're playing with the West.
So, Valinasa, what is driving this, though? Is it coming from Netanyahu, in as much as we've had reports in the summer from high-ranking Israeli intelligence officials like the former heads of Mossad, the former chief of staff, the former head of Shin Bet, an unprecedented pantheon of senior intelligence officials went public warning the Israeli public that Netanyahu's bent on attacking Iran. And then the U.S. has clearly been behind the scenes trying to calm things down and trying to dissuade the Israelis. So has that led to the Israelis' leverage in as much as to saying to the Obama administration, look, if you don't let us attack Iran, then you better make these sanctions work?
Well, you know, the Israeli position hasn't really changed. I think the way we have to look at it is that the Obama administration had always said that sanctions are an alternative to war. But the new set of sanctions essentially across the line to become actually the beginning of war. There is a big difference between when you say, well, Iran cannot buy computers or aircraft parts, or it cannot do X, Y, and Z. And it's another thing when you try to cut Iran out of the oil market and cut the country's revenue completely, and you go to Ghana and Libya and Equatorial Guinea and say, you know, you should invest in long-run production that would replace Iranian oil. That really is a point at which sanctions become an act of war. And the Iranians are really treating these sanctions now as having passed the point of just being punitive and a substitute to war, to really being the beginning of something completely different. So I think, you know, there is a disconnect in the sense that in the United States, the perception is that these are more sanctions, tougher sanctions. They are still an alternative to war. They also can persuade the Israelis not to take any action on their own, but the Iranians are beginning to see this as no different from a military action. So the situation we may be facing is that for a long time, we thought war would come when the U.S. administration or the Israeli government sit down and make a decision that, okay, tomorrow morning we're going to attack this nuclear facility or that missile facility. But we're in a situation where war is now gradually brewing because of the escalation of tensions that are created by these new set of sanctions. So we may end up at war, not based on a premeditated American or Israeli decision, but as a consequence of a gradual heightening of tensions.
So surely, Vali Nasir, you served in the Obama administration. Surely this is a nightmare for President Obama in an election year, isn't it? You already have the Republican candidates tripping over themselves to be more belligerent and bellicose towards Iran and basically saying that he's weak and he's allowed he abandoned the Green Movement, which is an absurd charge, which they all made in the last couple of days. Of course, had the U.S. supported the Green Movement, that would have provided the Iranian government with the very proof that they were trying to proffer any rate, that this was all a CIA plot. So, I mean, what they're saying is not just stupid, it's dangerous. And my feeling is that he's in a no-win situation here, because at the very least, the prices of oil is going to go up, and it already is going up as a result of the tension.
Right. Right. I mean, in some ways, you know, this new set of sanctions probably were the least painful and least difficult and least confrontational option President Obama could have chosen. And they are still so draconian that the Iranians are reacting to it. The problem is, in a way, is that when President Obama had the opportunity between 2009 and 2011 for serious diplomacy, he didn't opt for it. And instead, he opted for a policy of pressure. Pressure didn't work. So come 2011, because of domestic American politics, he cannot take his pedal off of pressure. The only option he faces is to add more pressure. But this is already a dead-end strategy that, by and large, only placates domestic public opinion to back off the Republicans. But it really doesn't serve the purpose of solving this crisis. And you know, in some ways, the first 2 years of his administration now is sort of lost opportunity. I disagree with Robert Baer that the president actually seriously tried diplomacy. At a rhetorical level, yes, he made an intention that he was open to talking to Iran. And other than one meeting initially in Geneva and later on another one in Istanbul, there was no real engagement with Iran. This diplomacy requires a lot of footwork, a lot of engagement, a lot of patience, a lot of signaling, a lot of tit-for-tat. And it's possible that the Iranians would have reciprocated or not, but that was not really tested. So, you know, sanctions was used very early on as an alternative to both war and to diplomacy, with the expectation that you raise the pressure, the Iranians show up at the table and sign a suspension of enrichment. But it didn't work out that way. And now, you know, as you mentioned, he's cornered himself in a position that, because of domestic politics, he cannot back off. And he's actually being pushed to escalate tensions. But that's also pushing us closer to war.
So do you then buy the notion, Vali Nasir, that the Iranians are not interested in diplomacy because the IRGC and the Supreme Leadership are so invested in the great Satan, they're not going to give that up?
No, I think, you know, they are invested in all of that. And diplomacy is always difficult. Look at the Arab-Israeli peace process. It took 10 years of Oslo peace process for it to fail. Diplomacy, even in the best of days and best of times, is very difficult. It's tedious. It's two steps forward, three steps backward before it yields any results. But I think right now, at the moment we are, the issue is much, much simpler for Iran. There is no path forward for them that actually would get into a good place. New sanctions are coming to the fore that can, in the long run, cut them out of the oil market in some ways permanently. As new contracts are not being renewed, other countries are being encouraged and given money to build capacity to replace Iranian oil. So you know, if Iran came to the table, this won't go away unless it sort of surrendered. And if it surrendered, then it's vulnerable to many other sorts of pressures internally and externally. So the Iranians don't see really currently any diplomatic alternative on the table. They are desperately trying to dissuade the West from going through with the sanctions. And the only card they have to dissuade the West is to tell them that, you know, if you do this, there is cost for you too. And that cost is called higher oil prices. So in a very, this is not a paranoia or irrationality or ideology. They have only one trump card left at this point in time, and that is the oil prices, and they are trying to aggressively use that before these sanctions really go through.
And on the other, at the other end of oil prices is the threat of war. So this is a, as you push them push their backs to the wall, they run out of options, and it gets more apocalyptic.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are many wars that have happened this way. When you know, one side can make a miscalculation, especially two countries that don't even have diplomatic relations, don't even have a telephone hotline between their navies that are operating in very close proximity, all kinds of things can happen. But you know, what we ought to think is that until now we thought that we will decide when war starts. And we will decide, you know, that it's going to be about taking out two or three or four nuclear sites. Now we're in a situation where we may not be deciding where war when war starts. And the war may not start over the actual nuclear sites. It may happen because there is a accident in the Persian Gulf, because during one of these naval maneuvers, something goes wrong. And as a result, you then have a situation of gradual escalation into a military conflict. So, you know, sanctions for about a decade have produced certain stability in this scenario, because we were pressuring Iran, we were addressing the concerns domestically and even those of Israel, et cetera. But at the same time, the sanctions kept conflicts at bay. Now that period has ended. Now sanctions are no longer stable, and they're no longer preventing war, but rather making it more likely.
So, Valinasa, would you have to add to this rather pessimistic scenario? It's not a scenario. I think it's a very realistic assessment of where things stand at the moment. Surely there are other wild cards in this mix, as bad as it is, and that is the disintegrating situation in Iraq, the likelihood of civil war in Syria, the isolation of Iran if they lose Assad, and Hezbollah gets isolated and paranoid as well. So surely you have to factor those externalities into it, don't you?
Absolutely, and we often don't do that. And actually, it is not only Iran that loses in this kind of a scenario. There are many other wild cards in the Arab Spring. We often think of that the Arab Spring has been unkind to Iran. But it has also been unkind to the United States. All of our allies are under pressure. We don't know what's going to happen in Egypt. Iraq, the minute that we left, is disintegrating. Afghanistan is not doing well. Our relations with Pakistan is collapsing. Our allies in Saudi Arabia, in Jordan, they're all nervous. In fact, if Syria falls, there are many scenarios in which that other countries could lose equally or more than Iran will in Syria. I mean, a civil war in Syria can jeopardize Jordan. It can impact Syria. It can impact Iraq. It can impact Turkey. It can impact Lebanon. And in many ways, you know, the region as a whole is also very fluid. Right now, we are sort of laser focused on the issue of Iran, divorcing it from the broader context of this region, which is quite fluid and quite unstable. And the Iranians also look at the same picture, and they figure that that might give them actually certain opportunities against us, that we might be underestimating their capabilities in the region and overestimating how much they have actually been weakened. The Assad regime may not fall for another 18 months or 2 years, during which time period, you know, the issue of sanctions, war, nuclear issue will continue to unfold. And we may be having also many unforeseen disasters in the region, a civil war in Iraq, a resumption of hostilities in Bahrain, a civil war in Yemen, some kind of a blow between the Islamists and the military in Egypt. All of these are factors that are there, and some of these factors impact us more than they impact the Iranians.
So just in closing, Valinasa, what did you make of Robert Baer's conversation that he had with the Muslim Brotherhood leaders in Syria, where they complained to him that the State Department wasn't supporting them, And then Bob asked them, what are you going to do about the Alawites? And they said, we're going to kill them. And then Bob said, well, that's the reason why the State Department aren't supporting you.
Well, you know, it was a very sobering observation. I mean, first of all, the State Department is supporting them as much as they could. I mean, beyond literally putting troops and arming the opposition in Syria, you know, diplomatically and otherwise, we're putting a lot of pressure on Syria, the Syrian government. We're putting more pressure on the Syrian government than we put on the Iranian government in 2009. The problem is that we have only so many levers in Syria. You can only push a government that doesn't want to negotiate with the opposition so far. But what Robert was basically putting his finger on is that Syria is not going to transition like Egypt, that, you know, Assad's going to go and the next day you're going to have an interim government. That Syria is going to actually explode. And if it explodes, we don't know what the outcome would be. And it could be many unforeseen outcomes. Israel could be a bigger loser than Iran. Or Iraq can be deeply affected by what happens in Syria. And therefore, Syria is sort of a ticking bomb in the heart of the Middle East that can completely change many of the conversations we're having about that region.
Well, Vali Nasser, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Good talking to you.
Very good talking to you, albeit depressing, but I thank you so much. Again, I was speaking with Vali Nasser, professor of international politics at Tufts University. He was born in Iran and migrated with his family to the United States following the 1979 Islamic Revolution. His books include The Rise of Islamic Capitalism, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World, and The Shia Revival and Democracy in Iran. Between 2009 and 2011, he served in the Obama administration as a senior advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking more about unrest in Syria.
يا حيف زخ رصاص على الناس العزل يا حيف واطفال بعمر الورد اعتقلن كيف زخ رصاص.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Muraf Shujati, who is a Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs, particularly Syrian politics. He's currently a professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. And he's also a lecturer in political science and international affairs at George Washington University, as well as a scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Background Briefing, Muraf Shujati.
Thank you very much.
And I must say that so far from the former CIA officer, Robert Baer, and from Vali Nasser, who served in the Obama administration, a very pessimistic picture of the general regional potential for a vast conflict breaking out, not just in terms of Israel threatening to attack Iran, but Iran feeling paranoid and squeezed by sanctions and striking out. And into this mix, you have these two very volatile neighborhoods that Iran's involved in, the Assad dictatorship under siege from within, and the very shaky government in Iraq. So with that as a predicate, into this mix, you have a Russian naval flotilla docking at the Syrian port of Tartus. You have an American naval flotilla and 10,000 troops arriving in Israel for exercises. And then you have the Iranians having more exercises to close the Straits of Hormuz. So I take it our conversation is not going to improve this picture, right?
In fact, there are further complications. The turmoil in Syria might well spill over into Lebanon. And in Lebanon, Syria has an ally that is Hezbollah, that in order to forestall the collapse of the Assad regime may itself ignite some sort of violence. So I agree, the picture is truly very, very grim.
So what is happening in Cairo with the Arab League foreign ministers meeting the Saudis and the Qataris, along with the Egyptians? Apparently, the Qataris and are driving, and so are the Saudis, are driving an effort to make these so far toothless monitors actually do their work. What they're also talking about maybe bringing in UN human rights monitors as well. What's your latest understanding of where things stand from these Cairo talks?
The Arab monitors have not done a very satisfactory job in that, first, they are not experts at verifying the stipulations of the Arab Initiative, which call on the Assad regime to withdraw tanks and heavy equipment from cities, call on the Assad regime to release political detainees, to allow foreign journalists in, and to cease using lethal force against civilian demonstrators. The Assad regime has violated every one of these stipulations. The meeting today in Cairo calls on supporting these Arab monitors, including, of course, to bring in some UN expertise to these Arab monitors. And the monitoring mission is going to continue in Syria. But again, thus far, the results have been very, very poor.
Well, it's not surprising, surely. The Arab League team that went into Syria after initially being rejected by the regime, and there, it appears to be some kind of a compromise was worked out, it's headed by a Sudanese general who apparently is a former military intelligence chief involved in organizing the Janjaweed militia to conduct genocide in Darfur. So it doesn't exactly give one any sense of credibility to this. Yet you see footage of these monitors being met with Syrian citizens expressing outrage against the regime. So, I mean, what can we expect from them? Do they have any? I mean, they've got to have some decency, surely, to see the glaring facts in front of their face.
Well, you're absolutely right. At first, Syria did not accept this Arab initiative, but only accepted it later as a result of a compromise between those Arab states that support the Assad regime and those other Arab states that do not. The compromise was to head this mission with a man who has, I would say, a very checkered past, one who is really not into humanitarian work, but one that has been responsible for many of the wrongdoings in Darfur. It is as a result of this compromise that we have this this shoddy team of Arab monitors. That said, although most of these monitors, again, come from states that are supportive of the Assad regime, still, in their report, they have reported of the massive violations of the Assad regime of the stipulations that were initiated by the Arab Initiative. So despite being, for the most part, pro-Assadists, they did still manage to give a report that condemned the Assad regime.
So what is happening inside in terms of the Assad regime? I mean, we know how ruthless they are and how they see Syria as their plantation, if you will, and they just simply can't get over the idea that the majority of their people want them out. But there's a substantial number of people who support them, particularly in Damascus and Latakia, and Vali Nasser suggested that it may take a long time to get rid of them, up, you know, a year or 18 months. I understand that the Assads are also digging in for a full-scale civil war. They're fortifying an area up in the northwestern Alawite Mountains and inviting prominent Alawite families to settle up there. It's kind of reminiscent of Hitler's mountaintop eagle's nest. What's your understanding of that?
Well, Ian, you're right. This is the Assad family is a family determined to hang on to power. And this is the bottom line. This is what is happening in Syria. It is a family that is determined that Syria is their family farm and that the Syrian people are their cattle. On the other hand, you have a Syrian population that is in an uprising demanding its freedom. You talk about those supporters in major cities like Damascus and Aleppo. I wouldn't go so far as to say they are supporters. I would say that these are people that are sitting on the fence because they are scared of the day after. Now, recall that this Assad family has been in power for the past 41 years. So these people are scared of the future. They have known nothing but the Assad family ruling. That said, yes, the Assad family is trying to consolidate its hold on things, and they are determined. They are determined to use to the last bullet in order to survive. But I am not as pessimistic as Professor Vali Nasser. I do not think the Assad regime can last that long. I am of the view that we are now talking about a matter of weeks rather than months. After all, the Syrian treasury now is almost deplete, and there are an increasing number of senior figures that are defecting from the regime. I think it's a matter of a short time rather than a long time for this Assad regime to collapse.
Where do you think the Free Syrian Army stands now? I believe they have up to 20,000 fighters. There's a unit coming from Qatar into Antioch in Turkey on the border there that's apparently well trained from being in Libya that's helping a highly mobile force that's helping the Free Syrian Army, who are largely just defectors, many of whom couldn't even escape with weapons. But my understanding is that there's also evidence just back on the Alawite minority, the 15% as opposed to the 85%. Well, not 80, I suppose 80%. What, 5% Christians? Is that about the breakdown?
Well, a bit more Christians, a bit less Alawis. Yeah. I would say 10% of the total population, 10 to 11% is Alawi.
But I understand that in some of the really violent areas like Homs and Hama, dozens of Alawite village chiefs have made deals with the Free Syrian Army, and they've refused to allow Assad's Shahiba to grab their sons to join in the killing.
You know, this is a complex situation. It's not black and white. It's not Alawi versus Sunni and vice versa. There are a large number of Alawis who are also resentful of this regime. And there are many Alawis, including in the armed forces, that would like nothing better than to defect. But again, you know, they live in fear. They are held hostage by the Assad regime. They fear for the safety of their families and so on. You're right. There are many Alawis against the Assad regime, as there are many Alawis that are supportive of the Assad regime, and many Sunnis that are supportive of the Assad regime. So again, it is not black and white. But the longer these atrocities go on in Syria, the more likely there will be a civil war. And so this is really now, the ball is in the court of the international community to somehow try to intervene in order to avert such a tragic situation.
So is that likely to happen with these meetings in Cairo of the Arab League to make this monitoring group more effective? Because at the end of the day, the more effective the monitoring group, the worse it is for the Assads, right?
That's correct. And this is why I think the Assad regime has absolutely no interest in abiding by those demands of the Arab League, because should the Assad regime stop shooting at civilians, should it withdraw tanks from cities, should it allow foreign journalists in, what you are going to have now is even a more emboldened population that is going to come out in the streets, and that could spell the end of the Assad regime. So I am of the view that despite the improvements that will take place within the Arab monitoring mission, that nonetheless the Assad regime will continue violating its stipulations, and that is going to enable the international community to step in.
But how does the, just in closing, how does the international community step in? Through the United Nations?
Through the United Nations. There are many ideas out there, the establishment of safe havens, the establishment of buffer zones, the establishment of corridors in order to ship goods, food, water for a civilian population, that in many, many towns have been denied these things by the Assad regime in order to deter them. So there are a lot of ideas out there. If this is not done through the United Nations, I suspect that Turkey to the north is going to likely intervene in some fashion, because there are, again, thousands of Syrian refugees that are already in Turkey, and there are thousands more, I suspect, on their way. So Turkey truly has an interest in putting a stop to this, and the worse the situation becomes, I think the more enticement for Turkey and the rest of the international community to intervene.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Muraf Shujati.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Muraf Shujati, a Syrian-born specialist on Middle East affairs, particularly Syrian politics. He's currently a professor of Middle East studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. He's also a lecturer in political science and international affairs at George Washington University, as well as a scholar at the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. So what did we learn on Background Briefing today? Actually, most of the program was really about what could happen in this election year, as the Republican candidates clearly are tripping over each other to be the first to bomb Iran. You've got naval exercises in the Gulf. The Iranians have just announced that they're going to have another exercise to close down the Straits of Hormuz. The Americans and Israelis are conducting an exercise at the same time. The Russians have just deployed a fleet into Syrian ports, beginning to feel a bit like the Cold War all over again. So we spoke with CIA Officer Robert Baer, who I spoke with some time back, where we created quite a stir talking about Netanyahu's determination to attack Iran and concern on the part of Israeli intelligence officials. Well, the scenario now is so much, first of all, everything that we said back then has proven to be correct, but now the mixture is even more incendiary and much, much more likely to lead to war, at the very least a huge spike in oil prices, which of course is a nightmare for Obama running in this election year. Vali Nasser, who just was serving in the Obama administration as a chief advisor to the special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, he followed up, and he was actually, I think, in many ways more convincing that a war was almost inevitable, because we're pushing Iran's back to the wall and they have nowhere to go. If you cut off their oil, their money from their oil, that's an act of war as far as they're concerned. So unlike Bob, who said that he thought the Iranians were acting irrationally, Vali Nasser said, no, they're actually acting rationally, and they are, in fact, in a state of war. And finally, we talked about what's happening in Syria, whether these Arab League monitors are actually going to have any real ability to look into things. And of course, the answer is the Assad regime will never allow that to happen. So that situation could, in fact, be a part of the overall Middle Eastern tinderbox as well. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. A quiet voice.